Whether or not the allegations of sexual misconduct against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh are true, they've raised important questions about sexual consent and how young people understand it. Farah Khan is a consent educator at Consent Comes First, a sexual violence prevention organization in Toronto. Farah, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you.
And what do you tell young people about what consent means?
Well, I think number one, as I talk about it, that it's a conversation. Too often we're taught that sex is something that is a conquest, and we really need to talk about it as a collaboration. And so a part of that collaboration is consent. And consent is not something that, you know, you sign on a contract and it's done, but it's actually a key ongoing conversation. You know, does this feel good? Does this not feel good? Do you want to do this? Do you not want to do this? And listening to your partner, not just talking over them or convincing them, but listening to them.
What about in the case of Brett Kavanaugh and these allegations? Again, they haven't been proven true or false, but what is being alleged by Christine Blasey Ford is sexual assault. Is that the way that you view those allegations?
I absolutely do. What we know about sexual violence is that when there's an absence of a yes, when someone does not feel safe or comfortable to be able to say no, that is a form of sexual violence. People have to consent throughout. And with sexual violence, what we know is that sexual violence isn't something that is the guy behind the bush or the guy in the alley. It's someone we usually are in relationship with, either as a friend, a classmate, a coach, a parent, a teacher. So we have to push back on these rape culture myths that kind of teach us that, you know, it's that stranger. It's not. It's somebody we know. And that's what makes the conversation harder.
What about when alcohol is involved? What do you tell young people about how to deal with consent when either or both parties are somewhat inebriated?
It's one of the biggest conversations that comes up. We know that 50% of sexual assaults include alcohol. And we're not saying that you can't have sex when you've been drinking. The thing is that can you consent to something? And consent is something that is freely given, it's informed, it's reversible, it's enthusiastic, and it's specific. And the challenge is when you've been drinking, how do you know that someone's consenting to what you want to do? And are you communicating that with them? And so we know that drinking can cloud and not allow people to give their full consent. But drinking is an excuse for your actions. You have to be accountable. And so when people commit sexual violence, like the conversation in this case, we have to hold them accountable. Drinking or not, they're still accountable for their actions.
What do you think all of this shows about the state of sex education today?
Well, I think you and I both know is that there's such a pushback on sex education, this idea of clutching pearls and saying, oh no, we'll teach them in the home. When we know that so many young people are not learning sex ed from the home, they're learning it from the media, they're learning it from the porn that they're consuming or the conversations that they're seeing online. And the thing is that we need to have comprehensive sexual health education. It's not just about teaching people that rape is bad. They know that already. What it actually is teaching is how to have communication with your partner, how to tell somebody, yeah, that feels really good, or no, that doesn't. Or pushing back on this idea that young men are always up for sex and that they don't have also the right to say no. And so I think comprehensive sexual health education is the key and cornerstone to actually addressing sexual violence.
We just had required workplace sexual harassment training here at where I work, and it was interesting to go through given what's going on in the news right now. But one of the things that came up was a section about blurred memory. It said the flood of hormones triggered by a sexual assault can lead to the victim's memory of the trauma being fragmented and difficult to recall, especially in a linear fashion. This in turn leads to the confusion and hesitancy that can be interpreted as clues of dishonesty. Now, there are a lot of questions right now being raised by many, including Republicans, about whether the accusers of Brett Kavanaugh are remembering things properly, whether it was actually him. What do you think about that? How do you teach people how to deal with allegations like this?
Well, I think there's lots of pieces here I think we need to understand about the mythologies around sexual assault. So there's a lot of mythologies like they were asking for it, somehow, you know, it's their fault. These ideas of locker room talk, those are all sexual assault myths. Similar to memory, I think there's been such a conversation with the police across North America around the idea that do not interview people right away because actually their memory is not going to be as clear. When people are traumatized, they oftentimes have three kind of responses: flight, fight, or freeze. And so people can have different reactions to sexual violence. It doesn't mean it's not valid. It doesn't mean that it didn't happen, but the reactions can be varied. And we can't have one idea of what it means to be a survivor or how to react to sexual violence. Similarly, in these situations, what we don't want to have is that survivors around us start thinking that they can't trust us. Because this is the thing. When we say things that shame and blame people that have been sexually assaulted, we may not realize, but there are always survivors in the room. There are always people that have been sexually assaulted in your spaces, knowing that the stats are 1 in 3 women and 1 in 6 men in their lifetime.
That's Farah Khan, who is a consent educator at Consent Comes First in Toronto. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It was great.